Good morning. Perhaps I could cut across your conversation, draw your attention this way. Welcome to Grace Church. If you're a visitor here with us, I'd like to add my welcome to the one that Matt has already given you at the start of the meeting. My name's Andrew, one of the leaders here at Grace Church. We're continuing our series this morning based on John's account of Jesus' life. If you've got a Bible with you, it would be really helpful for you to have the passage in front of you, although we'll also have it up on the screen in a few moments. We're going to be in John chapter 11 this morning. A quick shout out for all the dads. My sons came in this morning and presented me with chocolate, whereupon they said, "Of course, Daddy, you're going to share this chocolate with us, aren't you?" And I was then presented with a sandwich toaster, whereupon I used it to make my boys their breakfast. So I'm really enjoying my experience of Father's Day. And you dads, I hope you are too. John chapter 11, before we get there, let me just give this a little bit of context. It's one thing to exist. It's another thing to truly have life. John presents Jesus to us as the great life giver, the one who gives us life, not just physical life, not merely physical life, but spiritual life. Jesus makes us alive to God and enables us to participate in the life of God. So one of the first things that John says about Jesus, right at the start of his account of Jesus' life, is in John chapter 1, verse 4. In Jesus was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. In him was life. Right at the start of his account, John presents us with two moments when Jesus is in dialogue with somebody else. And we looked at these a few weeks ago. The first is in John chapter 3. And Jesus is in dialogue with a man called Nicodemus. Nicodemus has everything going for him. He's a man of repute and status and great learning. He's a great scholar. He's a man who's made it in life. But Jesus says to him, you know, if you truly want to know the life that God is offering you, none of those things that you might count to your advantage are really any advantage at all. You need to start over. You need to be, this is the phrase Jesus uses, you need to be born again. Because Jesus hasn't just come to supplement the life that we're living already. He hasn't just come to enhance the life that we're living already. He's come to offer us a completely new kind of life, an entirely different kind of life to the life that we knew before. You need to be born again, Nicodemus, if you're going to know the life that I'm offering you. Nicodemus is baffled. And the second dialogue is found in John chapter 4. Jesus is talking to an unnamed woman. She's an outcast. And Jesus says, I'm going to offer you living water. Water that speaks of life and replenishment and vigor and transformation and renewal. And then as we go through John's gospel, it's John chapter 4. John chapter 5, Jesus says, anyone who believes in me has crossed over from death to life. John chapter 6, I am the bread of life. John chapter 7, if anyone believes in me, they'll have streams of living water flowing within them. John chapter 8, I am the light of life. John chapter 9, where we were last week, Jesus restores the sight of a blind man. The whole point of that story is that Jesus gives this man new life. John chapter 10, I give my followers eternal life. And then we get to John chapter 11, where we are today, which is the climax of everything that's come before, in which we have the clearest picture of who this bringer of life really is. Jesus is presented to us as the giver of life par excellence. John chapter 11. Let's have a look at the first 16 verses. It's a long account, and we're going to break it up a little bit. John begins by setting the scene in the first 16 verses. Have a look at it with me if you've got a Bible in front of you. A man named Lazarus was ill. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister, Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay ill, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, Lord, the one you love is ill. When he heard this, Jesus said, this illness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed where he was 2 more days. And then he said to his disciples, let us go back to Judea. But Rabbi, they said, teacher, a short while ago the Jews there tried to stone you, and yet you're going back? Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in the daytime will not stumble, for they see by this world's light. It is when a person walks at night that they stumble, for they have no light. I'm sure the disciples could make perfect sense of that. And the story goes on, verse 11. After he had said this, he went on to tell them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I am going there to wake him up." The disciples replied, "Lord, if he sleeps, he'll get better." Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. So then he told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead. And for your sake, I am glad I was not there so that you may believe. But let us go to him." Then Thomas, also known as Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, "Let us also go that we may die with him." Right. Now, in this passage, John is setting the scene for everything that follows. Can I just have the sound down a touch? Is that okay, JP? Thank you. Now, firstly, John hints at what's going on off camera. There's trouble brewing over there. Jesus and his disciples are in a place called Bethany in Perea. Then a message comes to Jesus, this is very confusing, from another town called Bethany, which is in Judea. "The one you love is sick." Now, the disciples know that Jesus' enemies are over there in Judea, because Judea isn't very far from Jerusalem. So they say, "Lord, it's best for us if perhaps we don't go," because they know that trouble awaits Jesus when he gets there. And Jesus says, in effect, "No, we're still in the daylight hours of my ministry. The hour of darkness has not yet come." And at the end of John chapter 11, if you go right to the very end of the story, you'll see that this particular story marks the moment, not just where we get the clearest insight into the main message that John is wanting to be drum into his listeners for the previous 10 verses. Jesus is the Lord of life. But John 11 also marks the moment where Jesus begins his long walk to the cross, the turning point in Jesus' life in John chapter 11. All of that's happening off camera, but John focuses on three themes. And the first is this: Jesus' passion. Jesus is presented to us as a man of deep emotion. The message that comes to Jesus is framed this way: "The one you love is sick." And then we read in verse 5, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Jesus loves these people deeply from the heart. It's a key theme that John goes on to develop in the later part of the story. Listen out for it. And there are two other themes which I'm going to take together: glory and faith. Now, what's quite unusual about this story is that all of the teaching is at the front end. Because what often happens in the accounts of Jesus' life that we find in the Bible is this: an incident occurs, Jesus does something extraordinary, and then Jesus has a debrief with the disciples. "Now, chaps, let's just reflect on what's happened, shall we? Consider what we've learned." Or you have a comment from the narrator who jumps into the narrative at that point to make sense of what has just happened. The event is interpreted for those of us who are reading it. That doesn't happen in John chapter 11. If you read to the end of John chapter 11, or this incident in John chapter 11, the story stops and that's it. Because all of the interpretation is at the front end. Everything's included in the introduction, which means, of course, that the ending is spoiled for us, because we know how things are going to unfold in this story. We know that Lazarus is dead, and we know that Jesus is somehow going to intervene and do something extraordinary that only he can do. So there's not much suspense building as we read this story. We know where this is going. All of the teaching, all of the interpretation is at the front end. And Jesus tells his disciples at the outset, this is what this incident is all about. It's about glory and it's about faith. Look at what he says in verse 4. This illness, Lazarus's illness, will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. The whole point of this incident happening, says Jesus, is this: that God may intervene and do something that only God can do. How's he going to do it? Through his Son, through me. So that people's gaze may be lifted heavenwards and people may erupt in applause going, "Well done, God, you do all things well." And the second thing that Jesus says has to do with faith. Verses 14 to 15, he told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead, and for your sake I am glad he was not there, so that you may believe." That word "believe" is the same as faith, which is the same as trust. Okay, we have different words for what the Bible calls one thing: faith, belief, trust. The whole purpose of this incident, says Jesus, has to do with God getting glory, God getting our applause. Well done, God, you do all things well. And so that you may believe, it's got something to do with your trust in God, your confidence in God being built up. Now, glory and faith, I think these two themes are really helpful for us as we're beginning to think through one of the knottiest, most difficult issues that any of us face, whether we're believers or whether we're not believers in Jesus. And it's this: how can an all-good, all-powerful God allow so much evil and suffering in the world? And there are so many philosophical responses that have been formulated to that question over the years. Has that question ever troubled you? I mean, it troubles me. Still troubles me. The Bible has a lot to say on the subject, but the kind of stuff that the Bible has to say on the subject of how an all-good, all-powerful God could allow so much evil and suffering in the world is typically not what we expect. The main thing the Bible has to say on this issue has to do with God's glory and our faith. It has to do with God doing what only God can do so that our gaze may be lifted heavenwards, so we may see him for who he is and erupt in applause saying, well done, God, you do all things well. And it's got something to do with our belief, our faith, so that our trust in God might be built up, our confidence in God might be built up. So as we go through the next part of the story, the incident itself, listen out for these three themes: Jesus's passion, God's glory, and faith or belief. Right, we ready? Verse 17, Jesus and the grieving sisters. So Jesus goes from where he was in a place called Bethany to the place where these two sisters called Mary and Martha live, another place called Bethany. Verse 17, on his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now, Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem. And many Jews had come to Mary and Martha to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary, her sister, stayed at home. Lord, Martha said to Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Martha's heart is broken. If only you had been here, Jesus, this wouldn't have happened. Now, contrary to what I used to think, and even contrary to what I've taught previously from this passage, if the commentators are to be believed, even if Jesus had responded immediately to the message when the sisters sent for him, he still wouldn't have arrived in time to have stopped Lazarus from dying. Because Jesus receives the message, then he delays 2 days. Then he goes to where the sisters are. That's a day's journey. And by the time he gets there, Lazarus has already been dead for 4 days. In other words, Lazarus must have died between the sisters sending the message to Jesus and Jesus receiving it. Lazarus is already dead by the time that Jesus receives the message. So when Mary says to him, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died, it's not an expression of reproach, but of regret. She's not saying, why didn't you get here sooner? Why did you delay? Why didn't you drop everything that you had going on and come immediately to stop my brother from dying? She's not saying that. She's saying, if only you had been here. There are a lot of if onlys in life, aren't there? If only. Oh, Jesus, only you'd been here. And then she says, verse 22, it's very interesting, but I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. That sounds like faith, doesn't it? Jesus' ears prick up. He's always on the lookout for faith, always listening out for it all the time. That sounds like an expression of faith. So he begins to probe, begins to dig a little bit to see how genuine this faith is, how deep this faith goes. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. He's dead, but he will rise again. Martha answered, I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Martha goes into her theological box and picks out some information. She believes what most devout Jews believed at that time, which is that at the end of history, God will draw history to a glorious climax, and those who have died will be raised to new life. Now, if Jesus was like you or me, he would have entered into a pastoral conversation with Martha at that point. He would have said, of course, you'll see your brother again one day. We say these kinds of things to one another, don't we? To console one another. They're not bad things to say. Of course, you're going to see your brother again. Won't it be wonderful on that day? You've been watching as your brother's been eaten away by some kind of horrible disease. But just think, Martha, on that final day when your brother is raised to new life, it will be a new, glorified, beautified version of his former self. And you'll be reconciled. You'll be reunited with your brother. Won't that be? Those are the kinds of conversations that we have. But Jesus isn't like us. He doesn't have that conversation. He comes crashing in with a statement that blows apart all of Martha's theological categories. Look at what he says in verse 25. I am the resurrection and the life. Jesus really isn't like us at all. Extraordinary statement. You're looking to a time in the future when your brother will be raised to new life. Don't look to a time in the future. Look to a person in the here and now. I am the resurrection and the life that your brother will know on that final day when he'll be raised to new life and be renewed and restored and be fully all that God created him to be. That life is the life that I make available in the here and now. I am the resurrection and the life. I bring the glorious life of the future into the present. You don't need to wait for it. And then he says, the one who believes in me will live. If you have faith in me, you'll live. You'll know life, the life of God, the resurrection life, the life of the future, eternal life. The Bible uses all of these terms that speak about much the same thing. I've come that you might have life, even though in the fullness of time you may die. Whoever lives by believing in me will never die. The life that I offer is a life that you can know in the here and now, but it's a life that goes on forever. It's a life for which death is only a comma rather than a full stop. And then he says, do you believe this? Verse 27, yes, Lord, she replied, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who is to come into the world. Now, then Martha's sister Mary is drawn in. Verse 28, after she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. The teacher is here, she said, and is asking for you. When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house, comforting her, noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. In other words, she repeats exactly what her sister Martha has said to Jesus previously. When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? He asked. Come and see, Lord, they replied. Jesus wept. Shortest verse in the Bible. Jesus wept. We have a coming together of ideas here that are so rich, so beautiful. We're touching upon something so deep and so mysterious that Jesus is there. God is at the graveside of Lazarus right now. What does God do when he's at the graveside of Lazarus? What does God do when he's in the midst of all of these mourners? What does God do when he's in the company of people who are grieving for their dear brother who's been snatched away from them in the prime of his life? It's not right. He weeps. He weeps. God is not a God who is aloof and detached. He's not a God who is up there, distant, somewhere up in heaven where everything is sweetness and light, taking some kind of perverse pleasure in us as we work out our lives in this grubby, broken world. He's not sat there up in heaven moving our lives around some kind of cosmic game board. He's a God who enters in. A God who enters into our suffering, who doesn't just identify with us in our suffering, but empathizes with us in our suffering. He is a God who weeps. A Muslim could never say that about the God that they believe in. Allah cannot be conceived to be a God who enters into the suffering of humanity. To say such a thing would be blasphemous. It would be perverse. Because it would imply some imperfection in Allah. It would imply that he's something other than wholly other and set apart from us. There's nothing like this God in any other philosophy or ideology or religious belief system. He is a God who enters into our suffering, who so identifies with us in our humanity that he weeps with us. Jesus wept. And then verse 36, the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" It's a good question, isn't it? Jesus, once more, deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been there 4 days. I like the King James translation of this verse. "But Lord, he's been there 4 days and he stinketh." Verse 40. Then Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said this, Jesus called out in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen, a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." And the story ends right there. Wow. Now, as I said, all of the interpretation, all of the meaning has been given us up front. So let's return to those three themes and reflect on them, and there'll be some application as we go. The first major theme, we've skipped through it. I've lost it. The first major theme is the theme of Jesus' passion. This is a story about Jesus entering into these sisters' experience of loss. They're grieving, so he grieves with them. He's weeping, so he weeps with them. He's mourning, so he mourns with them. The word passion comes from the Latin meaning to suffer. That Jesus is a God who enters into our suffering. Just think of that for a moment. He goes into the valley of the shadow of death with us. He walks with us, so identifying with us in the brokenness of our humanity. Now, you don't have to go far through life to experience the suffering of grief and loss, do you? Some of those losses are very great. We mourn, we suffer bereavement. Maybe you've known the kind of loss that devastates. The death of a child, a spouse, a close friend, suicide, or divorce, rape, abuse. The news of irreversible cancer, infertility, betrayal, the shattering of a lifelong dream. Different experiences of loss. Or other forms of loss are less catastrophic, but they're still significant. The loss of financial or emotional security. The fading away of a former friendship. Relationships that don't work out the way that you hoped. Children becoming less and less dependent on you as they grow up. A pet is run over by a car. Fire destroys cherished photographs. You know, my experience is that with church leadership, being as I am in church leadership, the experience of loss comes with the territory. Those lists of losses I've borrowed from a book that I've been working through recently called The Emotionally Healthy Church. And last week on Monday, I took this book with me to the beach, and I was working through a chapter that was on grieving and loss. Of course, this message was in the back of my mind at that time. And as I was sat there on the beach, reflecting on grieving and loss, I was overcome by a wave of grief. I was just sat there. Weeping. I'm not going to go into all the details, but one of the things that comes with the territory when you're in church leadership is the sense of loss that comes when people move on from the church. And sometimes that happens for very good reasons. Often that happens for very good reasons. You know, the Lord moves people on. And sometimes the Lord moves people on, they don't give the church so much as a backward glance. And you're there as a leader and just go, oh, just experience such loss. This may sound extraordinary to you, but there was someone who moved on from Grace Church a few years ago. I spent a year mourning the loss of that person. I kid you not. It's grieving for them. It's the sense of loss. That comes with the territory where leadership is concerned. If that wasn't the case, there's something amiss, something not right about the heart of the leader. And you may not identify with that at all, of course, but there could well be the experience of some kind of loss in your life. Jesus understands. He empathizes. He weeps. A writer from the last century called F.W. Borum wrote, "A tearless savior would have repelled the very souls that Jesus came to save. But one over whose crushed spirit all the waves of grief has surged must be the natural refuge of all penitent and contrite hearts so long as time shall last." When we experience suffering and loss, we so often want to know the answer to the why question. Why? Why me? Why now? Why did this happen to me? And sometimes those answers aren't immediately forthcoming. Often those answers aren't immediately forthcoming. But as we walk through the experience of grief and loss and sorrow, we can be assured of this. Our God is a God who enters into our suffering with us. He walks with us. And he doesn't give us neatly packaged answers to all our philosophical questions, but he gives us himself. We can be assured of his presence with us. He is a God who understands, a God who enters in. He is a God who feels deeply Jesus' passion. Secondly, God's glory. Jesus says in verse 40, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you'll see the glory of God?" Didn't I tell you that? The story of Lazarus is about Jesus stepping in and doing what only he can do. It's a story about Jesus making all things new. The mourners are stuck there in a situation of bleakness and rawness. They are in despair. All hope is gone. He's been dead for 4 days, and the body stinketh. All hope is gone. And then God steps in, doing something that only God can do. Now, the story of Jesus entering into your situation may not end in anything quite so dramatic as someone being raised from the dead, but here's the point. Jesus steps into that situation of grief and the experience of loss, and he brings new life to bear. He brings hope where there was despair. He brings light where there was darkness. He transforms that situation because our grief and our loss is God's opportunity to do what only God can do, that our eyes might be lifted heavenwards and we might erupt in applause and say, "Well done, God, you do all things well." Third theme, our faith. Verse 15, Jesus says, "All of this is so that you may believe." Verse 26, he says to Martha, "Do you believe this?" Verse 27, she replies, "Yes, Lord, I believe." Verse 40, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" Verse 42, "I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe." And the result of this, of everything that happens in this incident, is found in verse 45. We didn't read this far. We read, "Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did, believed in him." Now remember, the word believe is the same as the word faith, which is the same as the word trust. New life, the new life that Jesus offers, is available for those who believe. Put their trust in him. People of faith, people who say, "Jesus, I'm going to take you at your word. I'm going to dare to believe that right now, even here, you are in control and you've got me. You hold me fast. So I don't need to fear, I don't need to be fretful, I can rest in the assurance that with Jesus I'm in a place of safety, you're with me, you'll do what you need to do for the deepening of my faith and all for the honor and glory of God." That's what belief is. That's what faith is. That's what trust is. It's not just bearing intellectual assent to a bunch of doctrines. It's not belief. Anyone can say, "Oh, I believe that Jesus is the Son of God." No, belief. Saying, "Jesus, you're the Son of God, so I know that my life is safe in your hands. You've got me. I can't see where the answers are going to come in the situation that I'm in right now. But Jesus, I know that you're with me here. And I know that I can trust you and that you will do something extraordinary that only you can do to transform this situation. That's belief. That's trust. That's faith. Let me conclude. Experiences of grief and loss happen to us all. They happen indiscriminately. We're all in the same boat. We don't have any choice in that matter, but we do have a choice in this, that when we experience grief and loss, we have a choice of how we respond in that moment. We do have a choice of whether to flee to Jesus or flee from him. We have a choice of whether to hold on to our grief or whether to bring it to Jesus. Oh, Jesus, this is how I'm feeling right now. I just so need you to do something right now because I've come to the end of my own resources. That's the choice that we have. Jesus says, right in the middle of this account, I am the resurrection and the life. He's the giver of life, the great life giver, the one who makes the life of God available to us in the here and now. Who is that? Who is the life of God available to? Who is the life of God offered to? The answer, those who come to Jesus saying, Jesus, I'm going to dare to take you at your word, and I'm going to dare to believe that with you in my life, you can do what only you can do for the increase of my faith and all to the honor and the glory of God. I'm going to invite you to respond. The band's going to come up, ready themselves. Here's how we're going to respond. I'm going to invite you just to bow your head where you are. I'm not going to embarrass you. I'm not going to do anything awkward. I'm just going to invite you to bow your head and consider, do you identify with Martha and Mary in their loss? And if so, I just want you to sort of, in the silence of your own heart, to identify yourself before God by saying, yep, Lord, that's me right now. That's me. Or that has been me. And for those of you who identify yourselves, I'm not going to ask you to indicate, but those who identify yourselves in God's presence right now, because he knows. He knows the thoughts of our hearts. I'm going to say these three things to you, and I would love for you to receive them. And the first is this. Whatever loss you have experienced or are experiencing, Jesus understands. It's the first thing. He's a man of passion. He understands. He feels deeply because you feel deeply. He weeps with you. He mourns that loss with you. He grieves with you. He enters into your experience of sorrow. And the second thing is this, that all that you've gone through, all that you are going through is God's opportunity so that in the fullness of time, you can look back and see with perfect clarity, God, you are good and you do all things well. And the third thing that I want to say to you is this, it's a challenge. Will you choose to trust Jesus? Put your hand in his. Hannah had that beautiful picture earlier of Jesus taking our hand and walking with us. Will you slip your hand in the hand of Jesus and say, Jesus, I'm going to choose to trust you. I'm going to choose to bring all of my sorrow and my grief to you. I'm going to dare to take you at your word. And I believe that when my life is in your hands, it's in safe hands indeed. And his promise to you then, at that moment, is that you'll know life. It's resurrection life. Heavenly Father, let me pray. Thank you for Jesus. Thank you that in Jesus you met with us. You've entered into our humanity. Thank you that in Jesus you've given us this clear insight into what our God is like. A God who walks with us. A God who makes his presence known to us. A God who takes our lives and takes us to a place of perfect security and safety. Thank you, our lives are safe with you. Whatever we may go through, whatever sorrow we might experience, we thank you that you are our God and we are your people. And we give you thanks and praise. Amen.